Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire was produced on traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg, Haudenosaunee, Attawadaron, and Wendat peoples in London, Ontario, by Braden Alexander.
We're your hosts, recording on unceded Mohawk territory in Montreal at CKUT.
I'm Neil.
And I'm Janaba.
In this episode, the National Student Day of Action sought an end to tuition fees at post-secondary institutions.
Government's not going to look at us and be like, okay, you guys are right, here's some free education. It's not going to happen like that. It's not going to be an overnight thing. It is going to be a battle.
Outlaw and the Women of Color Collective discussed the lived experience of trans women migrating to Quebec.
I've had people, like doctors, telling me that they do not offer service to people like me.
But first, here are the headlines.
Carly Forbes brings us an update on Muskrat Falls.
On October 26th, an agreement was made between the government of Newfoundland and Labrador, the Nanetsiavut government, Innu Nation, and the Nanatukavut Community Council regarding the health concerns with flooding the Muskrat Falls Reservoir. The agreement included formation of an independent expert advisory committee that includes representation of all three Indigenous communities. The advisory committee is currently reviewing the engineering report and is expected to respond with suggestions to mitigate the risk of methylmercury contamination. Nalcor, a Crown corporation overseeing the construction of the dam, has stated that flooding is necessary before winter to prevent damage to the construction site. The building is behind and is $4 billion over budget, with the federal government announcing on November 3rd that it will approve an additional $2.9 billion loan guarantee. Community member Lonzi Michelin stated,
"This dam has been a mistake from the very beginning. It is billions of dollars over budget, years behind schedule, and because of this, the provincial government thinks that they can cut corners and skip over important environmental mitigation."
Billy Gauthier, Delilah Saunders, and Jerry Kohlmeister ended their hunger strike on October 26th at the announcement of the agreement between the Indigenous governments and the Newfoundland and Labrador government. Prior to ending their hunger strike, they held a rally in Ottawa with over 200 in attendance to bring national attention to the health risks associated with the Muskrat Falls Dam. Billy spoke to the importance of being able to continue to eat a traditional diet.
"And our people, all of our peoples, should be able to live on the lands in our traditional ways and actually be able to keep our pride, because our pride is what's keeping us standing, and our pride is what's going to keep us standing in the future." Yeah. "And we will make Muskrat right. We will. Absolutely. Thank you all so much for coming out.
Thank you.
While many community members are celebrating the agreement, concerns remain about the ongoing accountability and whether the health risks of water contamination will be sufficiently mitigated as the Muskrat Falls Hydroelectric Power project continues.
Make Muskrat right! 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 Make Muskrat right!"
On October 17th, 17 immigration detainees imprisoned in the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, began refusing food. The immigration detainees are calling for an end to indefinite detention with a 90-day limit on detentions. This is the third hunger strike that immigration detainees have been on this year. In the last 6 months, three men have died in immigration detention in Canada. The most recent hunger strike ended on August 15th after promises were made by Federal Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodall on a new national immigration detention strategy. In a statement published by the End Immigration Detention Network, one of the detainees on hunger strike spoke on behalf of the 17, stating,
"We have been on hunger strike twice this year, most recently for 19 days, at the end of which we were promised real change. The minister went on the record and said that immigration detention is broken, but he did not specify long-term and indefinite detention, which impacts many of us, separating us from our families and making us sick. Consultations were promised, and yet, have not taken place directly with detainees, while we are the primary stakeholders. We want an end to indefinite detention. We don't want to be locked up in maximum security prisons. We want real access to effective legal remedies to contest our detention.
Many of the immigration detainees are imprisoned indefinitely without charges or trial. Limits on arbitrary detention are recommended by the United Nations and are law in the U.S. and the European Union.
In June, the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia signed a peace deal to end a 50-year-old civil war. On October, a small majority of Colombians voted to reject the deal, with 50.2% voting no. Colombians in Toronto held a protest at Dundas Square on Sunday to urge the government to continue to honor the peace agreement. I spoke to one of the organizers on why they felt the need to speak out for peace.
We're here because after the peace agreements were defeated in the plebiscite of October 2nd, a lot of Colombians have mobilized to ask the government to implement the agreements that were already signed. And so we're here in solidarity with them. They had a huge march these past Wednesday, and we're here to show solidarity and try to pressure the Colombian government to implement the peace agreements. The regions that voted for the no are largely urban regions that are not really affected by the war. And regionally, people that voted peace are in the rural regions where the war is very strong and it affects them very much. So we know that the people that are most affected by war want peace. And that's why we think that they should still be implemented.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
You are listening to Groundwire Community Radio News, available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
Can't even
You just heard Everything is Leaking by Liz Solo. It's now time for our feature story. On November 2nd, a National Day of Action took place across Canada, rallying for universal access to post-secondary education. Organized by the Canadian Federation of Students, their aim is to reduce and eventually eliminate tuition fees. Mick Sweetman brings us this report from CJRU in Toronto.
On Wednesday, November 2nd, students across Canada took to the streets in the National Student Day of Action. The protest in Toronto saw 2,000 students march on Queen's Park demanding free education. Steve Cornwell from The Dialogue was there talking to students, activists, and politicians.
My name is Shayna Keeley, and I work at the Community Action Center at George Brown, as well as a George Brown student, retired student, part-time student, student with disability.
And I see you got a little guy here with you. What's his name?
And this is my little boy, Kian. He's 4, and he's in senior kindergarten. He's a future genius, as you can see, and he loves school.
What are some of the reasons why you're out here today, Shayna?
Myself, as a single mother who found themselves laid off in their late 30s, had to return to school. It's very expensive. There's a lot of barriers for single parents returning to school, a lot of barriers for mature students. And I'm really hoping that my son will be able to afford to go to school when it's his turn around. I have an RESP, but I'm not sure that that's going to be enough for how much the tuition is skyrocketing. And so we're really hoping that we can fight the fees and make education free.
Regine Hoylett is the chairperson for the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario, an umbrella organization of 35 student unions in Ontario representing over 300,000 students.
The public policy that has been coming out of both provincial and federal governments of high tuition fees and then high aid on the side just isn't working. It isn't helping people get through the door, and in fact, it's burdening students. We need to see them do more and do better, and recognizing that tuition fees are the most significant upfront barrier to education, if they're interested in resolving this issue, we'll see a reduction and elimination of those fees.
We asked Deb Matthews, Ontario's Minister of Advanced Education and Skills Development, to respond to the protests' demand for free education.
So I'm always happy to hear what students have to say, and CFS was here today making the argument that we should not charge tuition in colleges and universities. You know, I'm so proud of what we're doing to bring in free tuition for 150,000 students. The changes we're making to OSAP mean that we're going to be able to help students from families of income up to $160,000, and it's progressive. But if your family income is $50,000 or less, you're getting free tuition.
Andrea Horvath is a leader of the Ontario New Democratic Party and joined the student protest on the front lawn of Queen's Park.
So I'm here to say to the students of our post-secondary education institutions that I'm with you. Like, I hear the struggle, I hear the concern, and I'm not fooled like nobody on this lawn is fooled by the pretend free tuition that the Liberals have announced. It's very, very worrisome. Liberals are now talking about taking the cap off of the tuition increases. So the last couple of years it's been capped at 2%. If that cap comes off next year, who knows how high the tuition fees are going to go. Again, that's not the direction we should be headed. We should be trying to start with a freeze in tuition and start going from there to get things under control, because right now it's going to get worse and worse, and students are going to carry higher and higher debt loads.
So we're not looking at a freeze on tuition. We are looking at predictable, low increases in tuition. And as I say, that tuition framework is something that we're looking at. I don't think we'll get to zero. We really believe that post-secondary education is a shared responsibility. Students have an obligation to contribute, as do does their family if they're able, and government as well. So we're all in this together, but collectively we have been able to eliminate the financial barrier to post-secondary education, and that's huge.
So I'm Tiffany White from the Student Association of George Brown. I'm the Director of Education.
So you've been excited by the reaction that George Brown students have kind of given towards the protest?
Absolutely. When Rabia did the call out to all of the colleges and universities and she called out George Brown, we were the loudest. It just made my heart swell. Like, yes, awesome, that's my school.
What are you hoping is the outcome for today?
Honestly, media attention, 100%. Because realistically, government's not going to look at us and be like, okay, you guys are right, here's some free education. It's not going to happen like that. It's not going to be an overnight thing. It is going to be a battle.
And you're committed to keep fighting after today?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the fight doesn't stop just because today finishes and we all go home and put away all of our placards. No, we still keep going, because if we don't keep fighting, then nothing changes.
That report was by Steve Cornwell of The Dialogue and was produced for CGRU 1280 AM in Toronto by myself, Mick Sweetman.
Fight the fiends! Fight the fiends! Fight the fiends!
The Women of Color Collective and Outlaw presented a roundtable workshop of the lived experiences of trans women of color within the legal system. Speakers at the workshop focused on the difficulties faced by trans women immigrating to Quebec. This report was produced by Chantel Schultzman for Groundwire.
The event focused on the experiences of trans women migrants and of the speakers, Betty Iglesias and Dahlia Turki. Iglesias has worked in the Montreal area doing outreach and providing resources for trans people, sex workers, and LGBTQ immigrants in Quebec. Turki is an advocate for trans migrants' rights and helped organize the Trans March this year. The discussion was moderated by Florence Perre, who is intern for the Trans Legal Clinic and is the VP External for Outlaw and head French editor for Contours, Voices of Women in Law. Perre asked what problems trans migrants face with Quebec law. Iglesias answered first.
Yes, I mean, when we are talking about rights, it's there are rights where we are still discriminated. Why? Because credibility. Because the demands are really specific and we don't have access to provide that kind of criteria, like documents or papers, because we don't have access to it. In this part of the most precarious part of the precarious, I mean, like, we have refugee claimants who arrived here after a system that completely changed since 2012 because of the law C31. I come from Mexico, and I came in 2009. I navigated a very different system, and I witnessed just like people like me, we were going through difficulties in terms of recognition of gender identity and gender expression. That's something that the Citizenship and Immigration Canada modified just recently. Like, these are changes that probably they are implementing just now. But in 2014, the CCR, the Canadian Council of Refugees, they made this resolution supporting trans refugees, because we denounced it, like we denounced in front of them, like we need documents that allowed us to have access to essential health care, to the housing, to don't have to explain, you know, about your gender, your identity.
Next you'll hear Dahlia Turki's response to the question, what problems do trans migrants face with Quebec law?
So I'd like first to explain what's wrong with the Article 71 from the from Quebec's Civil Code. It basically forbids trans people from changing their documents, their legal documents. So basically, if you're a trans woman like me, you still have your dead name on the documents. You cannot change it. So basically, you still have a masculine name that I was given at birth and I did not choose. They still have male as gender designation. Finding a job is not easy at all when you're a trans person who does not have documents that match your identity. Health services, I've had people, like doctors, telling me that they do not treat or they do not work, like do not, you know, offer a service to people like me. You know, there is substantial difficulty regardless of the immigration status or the immigration process that the person went through. But I would think of it as being really specific to the case, individual cases. But of course, there are, like, the unfortunate ones will deal with, you know, extremely violent conditions. You know, for refugees, for instance, if you're lucky, they will let you enter Canada without having to go through detention centers. If you're not lucky, well, then you go to a detention center. If you had no luck at all, well, they will put you in the wrong detention center. Like for a trans woman, they will put you in detention center for men, and then you have to find strategies not to be raped, for instance.
You just heard excerpts from the panel, Lived Experiences of Trans Women of Color in Law, with speakers Betty Iglesias and Dahlia Turkey.
You are still listening to Groundwire, community news broadcasting from coast to coast to coast, and available online at www.groundwirenews.ca.
And now it's time for our community radio report. This week, we're honoring the amazing work that Gunarje O'Sullivan has done in community radio. Gunarje was the coordinator of the Resonating Reconciliation Project that led to 40 audio documentaries about residential schools. She is a volunteer at CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, hosting four radio shows, Sne Uwela, When Spirit Whispers, Late Night with Savages, and Kla Hauya. Groundwire's Carly Forbes interviewed Gunarje about how she became involved in community radio.
I went to residential school. I was apprehended at the age of four, and by the time I was five, I ended up in a resident and a receiving home, which is like a foster home for kids under five. They let me stay there shortly after I was five. I met an elderly couple who looked after me, and one of them was my great uncle. So he was related to me. He had a vested interest in me. But they took me from that family, and they put me in a residential school called St. Michael's, which is the same school that my mother, Thelma Williams, went to. And when I was there, it was a very sad, as they say, chapter in my life. It was lonely, and I kind of felt like I wasn't in control of my own life, which I wasn't. But the elderly foster care couple that had taken care of me, well, they were keeping a close eye on me. They didn't want to lose touch with me. And they had befriended a woman who worked on a cruise ship that traveled up and down the coast to Alaska. She had a gift shop and she sold souvenirs, Native arts and crafts and things like that. And she got to know the community of Alert Bay really well. All the elders, all the carvers, all the knowledge keepers and the speakers. And she encouraged those people to hold common potlatches in their big house once a week. When this cruise ship came in, all of the tourists would go by busloads up to the big house and watch these dances. Now, my mother, my foster parents contacted this woman, Kathy O'Sullivan, and they said, we know that you wanted to adopt one of the children from our community, and we've come to know you, and we think that you and Jerry would be a great couple to look after this little girl who has nobody, and she needs somebody to take care of her. And they agreed. You know where I met them?
Where?
In the big house. In our ceremonial house. They came in for one of the with a tourist and everything, and somebody from the residential school said, you need to go up to look at the potlatch there and be in the big house. That they want to introduce you to somebody. So I went, and all of the kids ran towards Kathy and Jerry because they were famous for bringing candy. So they're all running towards them. And I was kind of following behind because I was really, really, really super shy, if you can imagine. And my head was down. I wandered up to the couple. And as I was doing that, you know, my father, my adopted dad, looked at my mom and he says, listen, Kathleen, I don't think this is a really good idea because we're kind of old for to be adopting. But if it was that little girl there at the end, kicking the dirt around with her head hanging low, I would say yes, I would adopt her. And that's how I got adopted. And for 18 years, I lived in the Fraser Valley. I listened to CKNWU like almost 12 hours a day, I swear to God. And I realized that a lot of people, especially the government, really did not value First Nations people. They didn't value our values, our morals. They didn't want to hear about the fish anymore or any injustices. It always seemed like they were yelling at us about something or another, and it usually had to do with resources, the fish, the trees, the timber, the water, the oil, the everything. And there was a lot of stereotypical material out there about First Nations people. It really, Carly, listening to mainstream radio really gave me a hate on for myself. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was that I was feeling. I couldn't identify it because I was living in it. I never got a break from it. Until one day, when I was 19 years old, I went into Mission to get my status card. And while I was there, you know, you have to fill out all of your statistics, who your mom was, who you maybe thought your dad was, what year you were born, and so on and so forth. And we have a local newspaper here at the time called Catu. And Catu, and what happened was when I turned 19, my brother, Raymond Williams, who worked at Co-op Radio here on a show called When Spirit Whispers, which was on every Wednesday night at 11 o'clock, he put in an ad for this local paper saying that he was looking for his sister, who was probably adopted sometime in the 70s and who is probably around 19 years old, and her mom is Thelma Williams. Well, lo and behold, it just so happened that the lady that helped me fill out my application at the Friendship Center read the article and put one and two together. And she called my adopted mom and said, you know, Cheryl, that's my first name. Her brother is looking for her. And they hooked each other up. And my mom kind of met Raymond first, made sure that everything was copacetic. And then they contacted me. And I got to meet my brother for the first time.
Wow.
When I was 19. And he worked at the radio station. And he recognized that I had a gift for words, and he thought that radio would be a good fix for me. And he brought me into the station, which was located on Carroll and Hastings Street.
And that's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg, Haudenosaunee, Ottawa Daron, and Wendat peoples in London, Ontario, by Braden Alexander.
Headlines this week were by Carly Forbes, Ome Salma Rahmatullah. Music this week was by Liz Solo of the Black Bag Media Collective.
We thank all our contributors this week, as well as Gretchen King and Janaba Dale. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at www.groundwirenews.ca.